And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah.
What's going on, everybody? Daniel Jeremiah here, Move the Sticks. It is the off season, but we're not taking a break here on the podcast. Going to keep them rolling, and we have a big one today. I am so pumped up about the two guests we have on today's podcast. We're going to go a little bit outside the box to start things off. John Gordon, best-selling author, somebody that speaks to Fortune 500 companies, but speaks to a lot of teams, you know, college football teams, college basketball teams, a lot of NFL teams, done work with the Falcons. He's done work in the NBA with the Clippers, the Pittsburgh Pirates in baseball, and just about every Fortune 500 company you can think of. He spoke to these audiences about leadership, about culture, two words that definitely apply here to the NFL and into the evaluation process and scouting and the coaching side of things. So I'm fascinated to kind of get his take on those topics as it relates to the NFL. And then we're going to bring back Jim Schwartz, who was a big help to us in our Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota podcast, with his experience being around Matthew Stafford, being around number one overall pick, and his time as a head coach with the Detroit Lions, as well as his experience as a defensive coordinator, longtime defensive coordinator in the league. We'll get a chance to talk to him. And I want to talk to him about what coaches do in the offseason this time of year, what that schedule looks like, take you kind of behind the curtain there. But also, as we're talking with culture here with John Gordon, I want to talk to Jim Schwartz about that as well. Inherited an 0-16 team and put them on a lot better footing before he left there. So two great guests, and I'm really looking forward to today's episode. TD is not here. He is on. He's going to see his sister get married, right, Sean? Is that where TD is?
That's correct. Two different weddings too.
One in Nigeria and one in England, I believe. Right.
One in Rome.
One in Wow.
And then he's going to England.
Yeah. So TD's out and about. So no
World
TD
traveler
here on the show, but Sean's got us taken care of. By the way, John Gordon, our first guest, has done some work with your Tennessee Volunteers as well. So it's going to be a fun episode. And I think this is something, look, obviously if you're listening to this, you're a big football fan, but you have somebody that's in the, you know, maybe not a diehard sports fan, but in the business world, I think this will be a good episode for them to check out as well. All right, well, let's get right to it. The man I told you guys about, I'm so excited to have on the show today, and that's best-selling author John Gordon. Going to sit here and chat with us a little bit on leadership, culture, and how it relates to the NFL. John, how's it going, man?
Doing great.
Appreciate you stopping by here. I want to hit you up first on a tweet you sent out just the other day. And by the way, you need to follow John Gordon on Twitter. It's outstanding. His handle is at JohnGordon11, and you'll get lots of daily inspiration there, a lot of great stuff. But the tweet you sent out the other day, and I'll let you answer it. The question was the number one predictor of success, and the answer was?
Grit. The ability to overcome adversity, challenges, obstacles to ultimately create our success.
I love this because when I've done studies in the past on quarterbacks that have busted out in the NFL, when you're in scouting, you're always trying to – we talk about our hits and our misses. You need to make sure you're studying your mistakes. And the one commonality a lot of these guys have that don't hit is their ability to handle adversity. They have everything going right for them in college. It's easy for them. And then as soon as that first sign of adversity hits in their pro careers, you've seen these guys crumble. It's one of the reasons why when I look at Jameis Winston – and you know, he's had a lot of issues off the field, obviously, but he's been through turmoil, and you've seen him, his performance, be able to stay at a very high level. I know how he's going to deal with adversity because I've seen it. It seems to me, at least when I look at a lot of players that have busted out, John, and I'm sure it's like this in the business community as well, if you can't handle adversity, you got no shot.
I couldn't agree more. I study these athletes as well, and you look at these guys who face these challenges, deal with adversity, and how they overcome. You know, we measure their size, right? We measure their arm strength, but we rarely measure the size of their heart. You know, how bad does this person want to win? How competitive are they? And what kind of grit do they have to deal with the adversity? And what's their mindset? Like, how do they reframe the challenges that they have? Do they see it as a challenge, or do they look at you know, the opportunity that they can learn, grow, and become stronger from those challenges?
I had a chance to talk to Steve Young a few years back, and I asked him what he thought was the number one predictor of success for quarterbacks. And what is it? And he said it's the ability to come into a huddle and say, over my dead body will we lose this football game. So I kind of equate that to grit there as well.
Love that.
Want to hit you real quick on culture. This is a buzzword, and it gets thrown out there all the time. Every time a coach gets hired, doesn't matter, college, NFL, whatever the sport, I'm going to come in here, I'm going to change the culture. Chip Kelly had his famous quote where he said, culture beats scheme every day. Rex Ryan, you know, takes over the Buffalo Bills, and you hear all about this culture. What does that even mean?
Well, when Mike Smith came in and took over the Atlanta Falcons, I was actually consulting with him at the time, and we talked about the fact that he had to turn around the culture. The culture was in shambles. Bobby Petrino had just left. Michael Vick scandal had just happened. And the idea was that there's going to be a belief. There's going to be a mindset. There are a set of values and the way we do things. This is who we are. This is what we stand for. This is what we're going to be known for. And this is the kind of people we're going to have on our team, and this is going to be the kind of offense and defense we run. So it's a variety of things. Culture is not just one thing. It's almost everything when you think about it. It's everything that defines your expectations and beliefs, which then define your behaviors, which then define your habits, and then the habits create your future. So really it does begin with culture.
And expectation, I love the word there, expectation. How important is that when you take over a job? Of just making clear exactly what those expectations are for how you're going to handle not just what you're doing on the football field, but like you said, building that culture. I know I love the phrase you talk about. We got to win in the locker room before you win on the field.
Right, right. Well, you know, great coaches they expect great things, but then they inspire their team to expect that as well. So it's about having that expectation and then making sure everyone rises up to meet those expectations. You know, having kids is no different, right? We have these kids that we want them to be their best. So we have to have high expectations, but then we have to have the kind of nurturing and love, and I call it love tough. You know, I believe in tough love, but love must come first. So if we love them, we can then challenge them to grow and be their best. It's the same way in parenting and same way in sports.
Like Rex Ryan, I believe they took the entire team and went to a Jim Kelly event. And some people, oh, that's hokey. You know, come on, this isn't high school. You're giving up practice time. What are you doing? What were your take on something like that?
Yeah, it's funny. I just talked to a bunch of coaches at the University of Buffalo about that very thing, and I said that was the best decision he could have ever made. That one practice is not going to mean as much as building your culture, getting the guys to believe that they are a part of something bigger than themselves. They are part of this Buffalo community. They are part of Jim Kelly, which is so important to the Buffalo team, right, and so important to the history. So we are part of something bigger. And when you get the team to be a part of that, they come together, they bond, that is so much more important than practice. You do win in the locker room first, and then you win on the field.
Yeah, so that word chemistry, another word, a buzzword, right, that's thrown around, this is not bogus. Because, I mean, you can look, it's personnel. In personnel, it's very easy. You can break down the rosters by who's the most talented roster, 1 through 52. You can look at the 53-man roster and tell you who the most talented team is. That doesn't necessarily equate to what happens on Sundays. So chemistry, absolutely, there is something to that.
Oh, yeah. Team beats talent when talent isn't a team. So if you're a strong team that it's a connected team and you have great relationships in the locker room, that team is going to beat a lot of teams that may have more talent. I work with a lot of basketball programs, and I worked with Billy Donovan a few years ago when they went to the Final Four. They beat Kentucky 3 times that year. They didn't have one person drafted in the NBA, and yet they were such a connected team, and that's why they won. Too many GMs in NBA and also in the NFL, they get rid of guys with the mindset of age or talent, but they forget the influence that person has in the locker room. And I would actually keep some of those guys just for their leadership and their influence in the locker room, and that would actually go a long way in results on the field.
Yeah, that's interesting because that situation, I look at the Patriots, and that's a tough one for me because you look at it and say, okay, well, he's been able to build his culture. That's been very successful there where they care about one another. They are in as a team. But Bill Belichick, if it comes down to letting a player go 1 year too early or 1 year too late, he seems like he's been more along the sides of, you know, I'm going to get, you know, Lawyer Malloy, some of these guys, Wes Welker, I'm going to get them out of there a year early as opposed to a year too late. And that hasn't really disrupted their locker room flow there. How are they able to accomplish that?
I think, you know, in certain situations where you have such a strong, powerful culture and you're driving that culture every day and the coach and the leadership team is really driving that culture, you could afford to do those kind of things. But still, there are certain situations where you get rid of one piece of that puzzle, one piece of that team. That person might have had a great relationship with one of the, you know, one of the star players who maybe, you know, without that person, they become a detriment to the team. But with that person there, they actually stay in check. So you have to look at the dynamics and the chemistry in the locker room. You know, working with Mike Smith on this book, we're writing a book called You Win in the Locker Room. we're talking about what went right the first 5 years that he was the head coach. No one won more games than him in the NFL except Bill Belichick. And what went wrong the last two when he only had 10 wins in those last two seasons?
What you know, I don't want you to spoil the book here, but can you give us one little insight there into what in that last 5 years was maybe a little bit different?
Oh, definitely. I think I don't want to spoil the book too much, but culture really was the key factor. For the first 5 years, they really focused in their culture. They almost went to the NFC Championship, right? Almost mm-hmm. beat the Niners. They went to the NFC Championship, sorry. They almost went to the Super Bowl, lost to the Niners. And after that, it became about getting back to the Super Bowl rather than the culture and the process that caused them to be so successful those 5 years.
Yeah, it's all about the process. We hear that all the time.
And even the great teams, I mean, it happens so often, even Saban, right, with Alabama, mm-hmm. process, and yet we still see the team and the players get away from it. The distractions are so big that it causes us to lose our focus.
How was Urban Meyer able to do what he did?
That's incredible. That is one of the top coaching jobs I have ever seen in the history of sports, of what he did. I believe that was great culture. That was all about leadership. That was all about grit, right? E plus yep. P equals O. We can't control the events in our life, but we can control our positive response to those events, and that determines the outcome. So it was a constant sharing of belief, mindset, expectations, and ultimately a great execution and play calling for new quarterbacks coming in.
Give me that one more time. It was E plus, I know O is the outcome.
Yeah, but E plus P equals O. Some say E plus R equals O. It's we can't control the events in our life, but we can control our response or our positive response, and that ultimately determines the outcome.
Yeah, so in other words, there's going to be stuff that's going to come along, and this is as a player, as an executive, as a coach, there's going to be issues that are going to arise. You can't control those. You can control your response to it, and how you control that response is going to lead to the outcome.
Very much. And all the teams that I've worked with in college and the pros, it's interesting. Once they say, hey, we're going to be a positive team, we're going to, you know, for instance, do my book, The Energy Bus, they all then hit a challenge. It's like they're tested. Is this real? But once it is real and they say, you know what, we're staying positive, we're dealing with this adversity, we have the grit, it's amazing. That team always goes on to have a great season.
And your book, The Energy Bus, which I highly recommend. John's got so many great books. In fact, when I, you know, we've just developed our relationship through social media, and I tore my Achilles, as all our listeners know, and John got my address through a direct message and sent me all of his books, and I think I've gone through five of them already, John, and it's just really, really, really good stuff.
Okay,
and Energy Bus, I think, is my favorite. And one of the things I love about that analogy there is the bus, is the whole thing we always talk about, you know, you got to get people on the bus. And we use this analogy when I was going from Baltimore to Cleveland. In Baltimore, we had the culture. Ozzie Newsome has built that culture there in our personnel department, and we had that culture in the locker room. And because we had those positive leaders like Ray Lewis, we knew we could go out and draft a guy that maybe had a little bit questionable work ethic, John, because we knew we had a driver on our bus and Ray Lewis. They're all going to get in line. He's going to get them ready to go. And then you go to Cleveland, and we didn't have anybody like that. So we couldn't bring those types of players into our building because we didn't have anybody to drive that bus.
I love that analogy because you can give a team a bus, but unless you have a driver driving it, the bus doesn't move. So it really comes down to leadership. You know, with all the teams I've worked with, I realize it's not me, it's not a book, the reason why they have success. When you have a leader and leaders in that locker room driving that bus, that's why the team has success. When I was with the Longhorns the year they went to the national championship, I actually spoke to the team. They did the energy bus that year. They had Colt McCoy as a quarterback. They had Sergio Kindle as a great defensive player. When they lost those guys the next year, they lost their leadership in the locker room, and the team hasn't recovered since. So that leadership is so important. Those drivers are key.
And I want to talk to you about leadership, and this is not just even the leaders on your football team, going throughout your football team. Andy Reid would tell us in the scouting department in Philadelphia, and this is, you use the term the energy vampires. I'm going to let you explain that in just a second. But Andy would always say, look, everybody we draft, everybody we bring into this building, they're going to do one of two things. They're going to bring energy to our football team, or they're going to suck energy from our football team. So we got to make that decision on every acquisition that we make. We want guys to bring energy and just how important that is. And explain to everybody about what an energy vampire is.
Right. You could be a fountain or an energy drain to your team. An energy vampire is someone who sucks the life out of your team. They are really harmful to the locker room, and they will sabotage your team if you let it. I think the key with the energy bus and why it's been so popular with all these coaches is because it deals with energy vampires. It helps the coach get rid of the vampires that are sabotaging the team so they can focus on really creating a positive team environment, great, you know, generate that chemistry and focus really on what you do best. Worked with Georgia 4 years ago, and Mark Richt actually put a huge picture of an energy vampire on the wall. Anytime one of the players was being a vampire, he took the player's picture and they put it on that wall. And no one wanted to be on the wall. They lost the first two games, right? But everyone stayed positive. I sent Coach a text. He said, guys, John, the guys are still on the bus. They're staying positive. In years past, we've allowed energy vampires to sabotage our team, but not this year. This year, we won't allow it. They won the next 10 games in a row and made it to the SEC championship. A great example of a team that stays positive.
Yeah, to me, this is interesting. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, not put you on the spot here. But I, you know, people look at Chip Kelly and what he's done there with Philadelphia, and he's definitely got his way of doing things. I mentioned the quote that he's used, culture beats scheme every day. I know LeSean McCoy said that, you know, maybe there was a racist component to some of the things he's done there, and that's just been totally debunked when you just look at the guys they've brought in there.
Yep.
But to me, I look at DeSean Jackson, I look at LeSean McCoy, I look at some of the moves that he's made there. I get the sense maybe just felt like these guys aren't on my bus. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's the way I look at something like that from the outside.
When I see that from the outside too, I get the sense that this coach wants to build his culture, and maybe their influences are too strong. The longer you allow someone from an old culture to contaminate the new culture you're trying to build, the longer it takes to turn things around. So you have to make sure you're getting those energy vampires, you know, off the bus. And so maybe these guys were contaminating the culture that he was trying to create. Maybe they weren't all in. I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm saying maybe that's why. When I was with Butch Jones last year, University of Tennessee, I told him the Georgia story. The whole team, I told the story. Well, at the end of the story, Coach Jones says, all right, guys, all you guys take off. And he calls out 10 names. I said, Coach, who are those guys? He said, oh, those are energy vampires. I said, you're going to deal with it right now? He said, yeah. Why wait?
Wow.
He talks to the 10 guys. He comes out. He said, how'd it go? He said, powerful. He said, two are probably going to get off the bus, and that's a good thing. He said, but the other eight, they admitted they were being negative. They're going to be great influencers for us on the season this year. They may not play as much, but they're going to be great leaders for us in the locker room. And sure enough, I watched that team this year face adversity, come on strong towards the end, and then steamroll Iowa. So it was a great example, again, getting the vampires off the bus and focusing on the positive.
I'm going to do you a favor and just plug another one of your books, which I'm halfway through. I haven't finished this one yet, but it's fascinating to me, and it's the no complaining rule. Mm-hmm. And the whole premise, right, is you're not allowed to complain unless you have a solution. If you have a solution, then let's talk it through, but don't just complain for the sake of complaining.
Right. So complaining is toxic and will destroy an organization. Subtly, it's not as overt as energy vampires, but that subtle complaining can really ruin a team. I often say that complaining is like throwing up. Afterwards, you feel better, but then everyone around you feels sick.
That's a good way to look at it.
It's a horrible analogy, but people remember it. And, you know, Mike Smith, for instance, always had a no complaining training camp. So you tell the guys, hey, no complaining. We're going to focus on being positive. And sure enough, they would have more productive training camps as a result of doing that. But hey, if you have a complaint, we want to hear it. Bring us your complaint, but also come with a solution so we can get better. And so then you get everyone involved in the process and you engage your teammates more that way.
How about Pete Carroll and what he's able to do? You talk about changing the culture. I mean, he just turned over the entire roster right when he got there. And
yep.
And what he's been able to do, because look, I've been around that program a lot when he was at USC and scouting on the West Coast. I've never seen it. You know, when you go to a practice, and I'm sure you've been to many practices in all different sports, it always struck me how many teams kind of ease into their practice, right? They stretch, and then they warm up on the field, and they kind of talk. You go to a Pete Carroll practice at USC, and I know it's the same with the Seahawks. They are rolling. It is. You talk about an energy factory. Pete Carroll brings that in spades.
I remember I called Pete up when I was just riding the energy bus because he had so much positive energy. I never met him before. Got on the phone with him, and said, hey, I want to talk to you about positive energy. He goes, well, we don't really talk about it. We just do it. he said, that's what we're all about. I said, I know. That's what I want to talk to you about. What do you do?
Yeah.
And to see his teams and the positive energy they bring, it's so powerful. Gus Bradley and I have become friends, and Gus brings the same kind of energy to the Jacksonville Jaguars. He is turning around this culture. I know they haven't won the first two seasons, but he's doing the right things from a culture perspective. And people say, you know what, positivity doesn't work. Well, it's not just positivity. It's positivity with a drive towards excellence. It's competition and positivity combined with a group of people who want to be their best. And when you have those ingredients, that's what creates a great team. It's not Pollyanna positive. It's real positivity.
And now, the first book that I read of yours, by the way, which I just happened to pick up in the airport, and, you know, I had finished, I don't know if it was finished a scouting trip or what I had done, but I'd get in the airport, saw one of your books. It was The Carpenter. Picked it up, and this book, this is why your books are so great, because you can consume them over a long flight. You can go back and reread them. You can get a lot of stuff out of it. But The Carpenter, one of the themes in this book is you talk about being a craftsman in whatever you do and whatever your assignment is. And I look at, you know, when you're evaluating in the NFL and you have your pro scouting department, you're doing advanced scouting reports, and I used to have to do the special teams. And I was always amazed that some of the best core special teams players as rookie and second-year guys, maybe late-round picks, but these were guys like James Harrison who would go on and have unbelievable careers once they were able to get their opportunity in their base defense. But with whatever assignment they had, they were craftsmen. And can you explain kind of what that means?
Sure. There's a difference between a carpenter and a craftsman. A carpenter just builds something, but a craftsman – it's a work of art. They're an artist, and so they spend more time, more energy, more effort, more care into what they're building. So on your talent, you are getting better every day. It doesn't matter what you did last year. Your focus is to improve and get better every day. Talked to Damian Lillard a couple years ago after his NBA rookie season. Told me that he realized how hard he would have to work to make it in the NBA. So not, you know, working as hard as he was, wasn't good enough. He had to work even harder. He had to become a craftsman instead of a carpenter. And so we see the difference between the great ones and the average ones. The great ones, and it's a very subtle difference, but the great ones just care more. They put more energy and more effort into it, and they're always improving the subtle nuances of their craft. So it's the fundamentals, but then they're mastering the fundamentals, and that's really the key.
That's why when you're scouting, you go into schools, which, by the way, we need to get together. You've done all these books on the team side, and you've got every base is covered. We need to get together and do the scouting component of this whole thing, because
love
I think it's totally an area this stuff is so applicable there. And when I look at scouting players, and you talk about that being a craftsman and paying attention to it, I would always go to the guy, and you know, you talk to the coaches when you go into a school, you talk to the trainers, you talk to the strength coaches. I would go to the video guy who ran the video department and say, who are the guys that are coming in here extra? Who are the guys that are checking out iPads? Who are the guys that are, you know, if the video guy doesn't know who you are on the football team, then I know that you're not taking this maybe as seriously as you should.
I love that. You know, Mike Smith, as we've been writing this book, he told me about Ray Lewis and how much time he spent watching film and watching tape to get better. And then he would invite people over his house to watch film and watch tape with him. So I think that's the key. Not only are you trying to get better yourself, but now you're a transformational leader helping your team get better. But I just love what you said about that, you know, who go to talk to the video guys. That's really sharp.
Yeah, learn those little tricks of the trade there. But I'm telling you, this is bringing up all these old memories, though, with talking about Ray Lewis, because in Baltimore, John, I'm telling you, and Rex Ryan was great with this too, because he would say, get me guys, just get me good football players. They get in here, our culture with Ray, with the way Ray's going to make these guys work, and with Rex as a defensive coordinator at that time, the energy he's going to provide, we're going to make, you know, we're foolproof. Just bring in good football players. If they have some other stuff, we'll be able to sort that out. Then to go to Cleveland, and it was like they have to be this, they have to fit this spec. We were trying to find those leaders, and, you know, you only have so much time to build a roster. And that's why I hope with Gus Bradley that he'll get enough time there to build that thing with Dave Caldwell to get those guys. Because, man, once you finally get that driver, once you get that driver on that bus, man, it makes things a whole lot easier.
Oh, it does. And people often give the coaches a hard time. But you know, let's face it, you still need to have talent. You know, Chuck Daly, the coach of the Detroit Pistons years ago, who won, you know, championships and the Olympics as well, Olympic gold medal. He said, "I'm a pretty good coach when I have great players."
All right, last question for you, then I'll let you run. I know you're a busy man here, but I know one of the more intriguing coaches in the National Football League over the last few years is now no longer in the National Football League, and that's Jim Harbaugh, who's taken over at the University of Michigan. You talk about a unique style and a unique leadership. I know he has a big quarterback camp coming up when he's got Colin Kaepernick, a bunch of former NFL guys he knows and has worked with, and Jed Fish, their offensive coordinator, who I worked with in Baltimore, is there as well. They have a huge quarterback clinic. I understand you're going to be going there to speak to those guys. What are you going to have to tell them?
I am. I want to talk about the four stages of greatness. It's a new talk that just came to me. I was going to speak to the Pittsburgh Pirates, to the major leaguers, and was trying to think about what to talk to them about, and the four stages of greatness just came to me. And so shared that with them, and they really resonated with it. So it's something that is going to be relevant to these guys as well. And one of the key parts of this talk is that as we're striving for greatness, every one of us will get pruned. And the pruning process is not fun. It looks like you've been destroyed. But how you handle it will determine ultimately your growth and how you can grow through that process. And also constraint. Every person who strives to be great will hit a constraint. We all have one. You have to identify what your constraint is. What is holding you back? And if you don't identify it, your constraint eventually will bring you down. We see it too often in sports. We see guys hit their constraint and they wind up maybe, you know, making the wrong decision. They wind up making wrong decisions in life or with performance drugs or you name it. That constraint hits. But if you can heal that constraint and overcome it, you will then reach the final stage of greatness, and that's what I'm going to talk about.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Well, look, I know you're obviously you're very busy. You're speaking all over the place. Not we've talked about all these teams. You also go speak to all these Fortune 500 companies as well. But I've read your books. I try to apply it to my life, and it's really, really good stuff. And again, I encourage anybody out there, John Gordon. It's at John Gordon 11 on Twitter. There's so much good stuff out there, and go check
J-O-N
out.
J-O-N Gordon.
J-O-N. Oh, yeah, sorry, J-O-N Gordon. Look. Come on, it's still a little earlier here on the West Coast, man. I get a pass here. But anyways, everybody check him out and read your books. They're phenomenal. I appreciate you taking some time with us here.
Thanks, Daniel. Love your work.
Thanks, John. Take care, man. All right, Sean, behind the glass, taking over for TD. I told you who we had coming on the show, and I said, John Gordon, trust me, he's an author, he's a speaker. He's going to be really, really, really fascinating. Did he not deliver?
Oh, he completely delivered and shot it over the moon. Like I'm going to go out and buy a couple of his books. He was.
I know, and people think like I'm like he's asking me to help him sell books or something. Like
no.
I do all this stuff on my own. This is the first time I've ever actually talked to him. We've just communicated through social media, but
right.
It's really, really is fascinating to me. And you see just by the list of clients he has and who he's talking with, that he's on it.
It's a long and distinguished list. Growing from NBA to NFL to
Major League Baseball, and again, like I mean, the companies he's spoken to as well. But I just think it's fascinating when you look at it through that lens, and you look at some of the moves that have taken place, and what coaches are doing decision-wise, and you know what general managers are doing in terms of moving players, and maybe keeping a player a year longer than you think he should. I thought that was tremendous insight into that. So I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. And we'll definitely have John Gordon on again. Again, it's John Gordon, J-O-N, Gordon 11 on Twitter. You can follow him there. All right, we a little Ask Five time?
Ask Five time. Let's do it.
Ask Five.
Matt Money Smith, by the way, last week, he loves the he likes the big explosion at the end there. All right, so Ask Five, the way this works, if you're new to the show here, I'll reach out to five personnel executives and some scouts as well, and I'll ask them a question. And I'll get their responses. And there's five people that respond. And so you kind of get a little verdict on this. And this week's question that I reached out and sent to them was, if you're going to build a defense, so assume you're starting your defense from scratch here. You get three players. You get one defensive lineman, one linebacker, and one secondary player. Who would your three players be? So I normally when I do this, I reach out and I'll send a text to seven or eight people. And inevitably I'll get five back, four or five. If I need to get another one, I'll send out somebody else. So send a bunch of text messages out. So actually, instead of Ask Five, this is really Ask Seven, because I had seven people that are bored during the off season and replied to me. So here are the answers that I got from these seven personnel guys. The first one, J.J. Watt, C.J. Mosley at linebacker, and Earl Thomas. Next one, J.J. Watt, Luke Kuechly, and Earl Thomas. Okay, Kuechly gets some love. Next one, Watt, Kuechly, Thomas again. Next one, Watt, Von Miller, who they list as an outside linebacker, and Darrell Revis. And he said, this guy in the text message made a point, said, you need one cornerstone character guy, and that's what he had for J.J. Watt. He said, that's a no-brainer. Fifth one, sent in Watt, Kuechly, Patrick Peterson. And he said, look, it's a tough call on Kuechly versus Levante David. So Levante David got some love there, but still ended up going with Kuechly. Then we have Watt, Kuechly, Thomas again. Then Watt, Mosley, Richard Sherman. So the shakedown here is, no surprise, D-line, J.J. Watt, all seven votes. That was a no-brainer. At linebacker, Luke Kuechly got four of the votes. C.J. Mosley got two votes, coming off of a big-time rookie season. And Von Miller got one vote. Listen, him obviously is an outside linebacker. In the secondary, it's interesting because, you know, Richard Sherman, there's all the talk about Richard Sherman. He did get a vote, but his teammate Earl Thomas had the most votes. 4 votes for Earl Thomas. Then Patrick Peterson, Revis, and Sherman, they each got 1 vote apiece. So, interesting. I mean, J.J. Watt, that's the easy one. Linebacker, I wouldn't break from the mold here. If I'm going to give my opinion on that, I would take those 3 guys. I would take J.J. Watt, I would take Luke Kuechly, and I would take Earl Thomas. You talk about building your team up the middle, those are the 3 best guys in the business. So that's what that's the Ask 5. That's what they had to say on that one. And we're going to have Jim Schwartz coming on here in just a minute. And when Schwartz comes on, I'm going to ask him for his take on that. So we'll get another vote on that as well. All right, well, he's back. Jim Schwartz joining the show again here. Coach helped us out with our Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota podcast before the draft, and always has great insight. Jim, thanks for stopping by again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Daniel.
All right, I want to hit you up real quick before we get into some other topics. I just came off this Ask 5 question that I sent out there about building your defense around 1 defensive lineman, 1 linebacker, and 1 secondary player currently. I want to put you on the spot here, but can you give me 3 names?
Well, when you talk about up front, I think I'd have to go to defensive tackle as opposed to an end, because tackles are harder to take out of a game plan by an offensive coordinator. You know, you can chip a defensive end with a running back. You can put a tight end to that side, make him redirect. But the defensive tackle is closer to the quarterback, and he's harder to scheme. About the only way you can really scheme him is slide the center his way, and most of them are good at dealing with that. Had a lot of success with Albert Haynes working in Tennessee, and then in Dominican Sue in Detroit. So I don't know if I can choose just one, but I'd have to say defensive tackle, probably J.J. Watt or in Dominican Sue, as the defensive lineman. You know, linebacker, obviously you want somebody that can stay on the field all the time. You know, a guy that can play the pass as well as the run. And a guy that's, you know, consistent, can be a good leader on your defense. I think that's part of the job description there. And, you know, a guy that I've always really thought the world of as a player, he's only been in the league for a couple of years, but Luke Kuechly has a lot of Ray Lewis-type qualities in my mind, just meaning his ability to play the pass as well as the run. He can cover a lot of ground. He can play inside and he can play outside. You know, I linebacker, there's a lot of good linebackers, but I think he's special right now in the NFL. And defensive back, you know, I think corner is such a valuable position. The ability to take a player out, to be able to go through and say, you know, I can handle this wide receiver one-on-one with this player, therefore I can take my scheme somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to stop everybody one-on-one, but if you have one guy that you can take away one-on-one, it allows the defensive coordinator to have scheme to be able to take on the other guys, be able to handle a tight end, be able to handle the running backs and the other wide receivers. You know, so I'd have to say, you know, the cover corner in there. And I know he might be getting a little bit long in the tooth, but I still think Darrell Revis is near the top, or if not at the top, as far as that guy. And you know, he might not be the guy that you take right now, you know, saying, okay, he's going to play 10 more years in the NFL. But I think that, you know, he's a guy that's always had that ability. He can play the ball so well, he never panics. But his ability to handle one player one-on-one just gives a coordinator so much leeway to be able to handle all the other things that show up, the run, the tight ends, the running backs, the other wide receivers.
So it doesn't – to go back real quick to the defensive line point, it doesn't surprise you at all then when you see, obviously you coached him, but when you see the money that Ndamukong Suh commanded, you see the money that J.J. Watt has picked up, the defensive tackle position, there is something to that being a little bit more valuable than even what you get at a defensive end in today's game.
They're the closest guy to the quarterback. You know, that quarterback wants to set up in the pocket. They can be a factor in every single play. You know, if the quarterback throws quick, he throws on 3 steps or even some of the 1-step stuff that guys do now, defensive ends can be rendered ineffective on a lot of that. It's hard to speed rush. It's hard to be able to affect the quarterback if he's throwing the ball so quick. But defensive tackles are always in the fight. You know, you mentioned those 2 guys, the money they got. I also mentioned Albert Haynesworth and the money he got. And he got it for a reason. He was a game wrecker. He was very hard to handle inside. Those guys can affect so much Their ability to draw a double team in the run game frees up linebackers, keeps coordinators from having to spin extra player into the box. I think tackles are extremely valuable, particularly really good ones, guys that can still win versus double teams, and both of those guys still can. Both of those guys deal with all the attention all the time. Offensive coordinators start with their game plan with, we have to handle J.J. Watt, but he's still able to be effective. I think that's a sign of a great player.
No question. I want to get to the off season for coaches and what takes place on that side of things, but I want to hit you on quick topics here. Two more topics, and we'll get to that. Minnesota, Adrian Peterson shows up. You obviously spent a lot of time in that division against the Minnesota Vikings. What is the difference for this Vikings team now you get Adrian Peterson back in the fold?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a running back that, I mentioned J.J. Watt not being able to stop him with double teams. Adrian Peterson's a guy that you have a hard time stopping just with eight-man front. You know, a lot of running backs you can take out of the game by getting an eight-man front and, filling up all the gaps. He's a guy that even if you've got all the gaps filled, he can make a guy miss. He can run over a guy. We played him in the opener when I was in Detroit a couple years ago. And first play of the game, first play of the season, he took off for 80-some yard touchdown. And the rest of the game, we held him to like 17 yards on 16 carries or something like that. But just his ability to make that one play can make it very difficult. It affects everything else. And with North Turner is going to feed a running back. That's been his history, and that opens up his deep passing game. You know, people think of North Turner as a West Coast guy, and I guess he is, but he likes to throw the ball down the field. His wide receivers have always had really high yards per catch numbers, and a lot of that comes from his devotion to running the ball, and Adrian Peterson provides him that guy. Like I said, you can't feel good scheme-wise about taking him out of the game just because you're in an eight-man front.
Do you have to simplify things when you're defensively going up? You talk about eight-man front with Peterson, and how much easier, you touched on it there with the quarterback. I mean, is the scheme really, I mean, can you still be very creative in terms of your eight-man fronts, or is it going to be very vanilla for a quarterback like Teddy Bridgewater? Is he going to see a lot more vanilla defense now with him in there?
I don't know if it's necessarily vanilla. You have to figure out where the other defender's coming down from. You know, are they playing a tight quarters, which is really a nine-man front? Is the safety spinning down weak? Is he coming down strong? Is it a blitz eight-man front? You know, there's still some things for him to figure it out, but it does make it a lot easier for quarterbacks, and it makes it a lot easier for wide receivers when you know you're going to be one-on-one for a significant portion of the game. And that's what Adrian Peterson does. Yeah, I think Adrian Peterson is the best running back recently that sets up. He doesn't run the daylight. He sets up his cuts. He affects linebackers. He knows how he can affect linebackers. He can get them to commit to a hole and then backdoor and go to another hole. He's really, really good at that. He really understands defenses and how it affects linebackers. And I think he's probably the best in the business at getting guys out of place. You really have to have a lot of discipline to be able to play against him because, you know, he's always one play from breaking the game open.
So Jim Schwartz providing good news for Viking fans. We would never thought that would take place, but definitely exciting times for them getting Adrian Peterson back in the mix. One more current topic here, Coach. Cam Newton, new contract. I know you only played him once, right? 2011?
I believe so.
His rookie year. You got 4 picks off him in that game. He did rush for a couple touchdowns, but just what kind of a challenge is Cam Newton when you got to defend a guy like that?
Well, you know, his legs had a total different dimension. As a rookie, it was really unfair to judge him, you know, when we played him. Because very few rookies have total command over every part of the game. But he was a guy that could go make a play, and sometimes he can lull you to sleep a little bit. He might not be the most consistent player, play in and play out. But he's that guy that's, you know, one play away from, you know, scrambling for a big play, making a big play down the field. And I do think the game slowed down for him. Just observing him breaking down other people, it looks like, you know, he's letting the game come to him a little bit more. He's not pressing as much as he used to. It looks like he's taking a big step as far as leadership, and I think he's matured a lot, how, you know, his body language affects. I think he's been very open to the coaching that he's received in some of those areas. So I've been impressed with his development. I probably still need to make, you know, another step as a player, when you have a good young player at the quarterback position, and that's obviously a good position to be in for the Carolina Panthers.
Yeah, that draft, by the way, you go back and look at that 2011 draft, that's an all-timer, absolutely loaded. But, Coach, the reason a real reason I wanted to bring you on here is I like to take people behind the curtain here on this show and kind of show them what goes on behind the scenes. And I bet you a lot of people out there don't know what coaches are doing during this time of year. I know you got OTAs, you got a mini camp, but what goes on? What is the life of a coach right now?
You know, it's funny. A lot of times, even the players don't know. You know, the coaches will have you know, bags under their eyes and you know, be tired, and the players will ask, like, you know, what are you guys talking about? What are you guys doing? You know, I think there's a lot of things just to hit the whole calendar. You know, when the season's over, coaches usually evaluate their own players and their own scheme. And it's usually a process that takes a few weeks. You go back and watch every bit of film from your whole season again and look at it with a very critical eye. And you identify, number one, what personnel needs you have, but also what scheme needs you have. You know, what areas you were strong, what areas you were weak. And you forge sort of a plan. Okay, you know, we need help on third down. We were poor third down defense, poor third down offense, or red zone, or whatever area it is, run game. And you'll assign assignments, and you'll start looking at the teams that were the best in the NFL in those areas, break all those guys down, and looking for things that you can add to fit your scheme. And that's generally all, you know, in the month of January and February, maybe even creeping into March. As you get closer to March, you start talking about evaluating college players and NFL free agents, and that sort of commands a lot of your attention as you get closer to your off-season program. And then, like you said, then you start planning your OTAs. There's some things, particularly at this time of year, that we always did. You know, you'll look at your division really hard. You'll go in-depth into your division, who they drafted, what personnel changes they've made, you know, look scheme-wise, what coaching changes they've made, trying to anticipate what you're going to see from your own division. And you'll spend a lot of time on your division this time of year.
Would you dedicate one of your OTAs to a divisional opponent? I know, I don't remember if it was in Baltimore, if it was in Philadelphia, where I was, but I remember they would take 1 week in the off season, and each day they would, it was basically like a game week, like you were playing, you know, that team that week, so you would see their looks, and you'd actually practice against the team in your division. Did you guys mess around with that at all?
You know, OTAs probably aren't the time for that, in my opinion. I have done training camp with some of those. You know, you're going to face a particular scheme, whether it's, you know, a blitzing 3-4 team or, you know, a particular offense. You know, so you'll devote some of those times. OTAs are a time to install your own stuff. And, you know, it's such a short window now. You might even be talking about when there's 14 OTAs plus mm-hmm. a mini camp. You had a lot of time to be able to handle things. Now the window is so short, you want to get everything that you're going to install in training camp introduced in OTAs. You might not get all the way into it. You might not get a chance to practice it in depth, but all your different situations, your red zone, your third downs, your blitz, you know, your 2 minute, your last plays of the game, all those different things all fall into it. But you know, one of the other things that we've worked hard on this time of year were new opponents. You know, particularly if you're an NFC team, you're going to face an AFC division. You know, you're not familiar with those guys. So after your OTAs are done and, you know, coaches are free in the middle of the afternoon, you'll spend, you know, a day as a staff. And a lot of times your offense and defensive staff will be in the same room at the same time as you're looking at that division. And you're devoting some time trying to put some ideas in the back of your mind for when you play them over the course of the season. And then as you're getting really close to going on vacation, you want to make sure that your first couple opponents, that you have some games broke down on those guys, because those are teams that, you know, the only thing that you'll really have in your breakdown is preseason games. Mm-hmm. So you get some of last year's games and get that. And then the other thing you want to do is you want to make sure all your training camp schedules and installations are all where you want them to be. It's a busy time. Right now is a very, very busy time for coaches.
What about coaches, Coach?
During the season work, you know, till midnight and later quite a bit. And it's not unusual to see coaches during the OTAs and mini camp in the office 10, 11, midnight, you know, on a regular basis.
Yeah, I can confirm that. The off season, there really is no such thing except for that little break you get right before training camp. I want to put this scenario out there to you. So let's say you're the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, and they play Philadelphia week one. So now you've got Sam Bradford, who's going to be taking over for the Eagles at quarterback. Now, when you're breaking down that tape right now to try and get ready for those early opponents, and that's the opener, how much time are you going to spend, you know, watching Chip Kelly in Philly versus going back and watching Sam Bradford the last time he was on the field?
You'll watch Sam Bradford for sure. It always starts with a quarterback, and you want to have a good feel for what he's good at and what he's not, how you can, you know, just a comfort level with what he can do on the field, because whatever scheme you're in, they're going to do what the quarterback can do. But then again, he's going into a Chip Kelly offense, and you pretty much know what you're going to get with that. So I think, you know, probably about two-thirds of the time you're going to spend on scheme, but it always starts with the quarterback. So you're definitely going to go back and see, you know, how he throws when he's going to his left, how he throws when he's out of the pocket, versus how he throws when he's inside the pocket, you know, different areas of the field, how he handles blitz, how good he is, you know, in pressure situations, two-minute situations, all those different things, because those really don't change. You know, you can go to a different scheme, but those are sort of, you know, things that, you know, that define a player and don't change very much if they switch teams.
All right, last thing for you here, and I appreciate you taking some time for us. I need you to confirm a story. I don't think we've talked about this before because it was always rumored to me. But when I was in Baltimore scouting and you were in Tennessee, we had a couple playoff games. But the one in Baltimore, I was told that – I don't know if it was you or Coach Fisher, but when Ray was coming out of the tunnel, that you guys purposely warmed up on the other end of the field and faced the other direction so that the young guys wouldn't watch Ray Lewis when he came out of the tunnel. Is that a correct, or is that a myth?
That's true. You know, our advanced scout came back, and Baltimore's a tough place to play. Go and look at Baltimore's record in Baltimore, the Ravens' record in Baltimore. They're a great home team, and that was going to be a tough game. And our advanced scout talked about their introductions and how much it fired the crowd up and how long it took and everything else. And back then, they also introduced the opposing team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Baltimore crowd was vicious on the opposing team. So we made the decision. It was funny. Jeff came into my office and was talking about it. And I said, you know, we shouldn't even introduce the team. Just run out there as a team. Why subject our players to, you know, all the catcalls and everything else? So that was the first thing we did. But the second thing, that just because the pregame took so long, it really didn't have anything to do with Ray Lewis. It was how long it took, all the pyrotechnics and mm-hmm. everything, and you're sitting on the sideline ready to go, and you have to sit there and watch it. So Jeff decided to take the team down and run some plays, and just to give them something to do when all that other stuff was going on. So we did. The thing that came out of that we really didn't expect is the crowd was really, really loud at that point when, you know, all those guys are coming out. Mm-hmm. And our offense got used to handling the crowd noise before the game even started. You know, pregame warm-ups, you really don't have to handle the crowd noise. But the crowd noise was at the apex during the introductions. And that sort of settled our team down, settled the offense down. They got used to what it was going to be like. You know, when they got out there on the first series of the game, and we didn't have the offsides and the false starts and the things like that. So that was an unintended side effect of that plan. But, yeah, that's a true story.
See, that's been confirmed. I remember sitting up in their press box going, what the heck are they doing? They're down there running plays while our guys are running out of the tunnel. But there was some method to the madness there.
Yeah, I did it when I was head coach in Detroit. I did it at Seattle. When they were doing their 12th man. And it's no disrespect or anything else. You're just trying to get your own team ready and keep them focused on the task at hand. And I thought it made a big difference then also. You know, it's just a way to try to keep your guys focused, you know, in a part of the game where they're chomping at the bit, they're ready to go. And how many times you get out on that field and, you know, it seems like it's forever from the time you take the field. So they call for the captains, they, you know, go through the national anthem and everything. You got to keep your players focused during that time because, you know, you can get unsettled in that period of time also.
Well, Coach, I appreciate you stopping by again. Again, if you didn't catch Coach the first time around, go listen to those Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota podcasts. He has some great stuff there as well, and hopefully we'll get you on here as we go through the season once everything cranks up in the fall here, Coach. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thanks, Daniel.
All right, thanks. All right, well, that's a jam-packed episode for us today. John Gordon was outstanding, and then Jim Schwartz coming on with some great insight as well. So jam-packed episode. One thing I didn't get a chance to ask Coach, which I wanted to at the end, is John Gordon went to Cornell, and Jim Schwartz went to Georgetown. I was going to see what the better degree of those two was. Or see, maybe if you got accepted into those Ivy Leagues. If you get into Georgetown, Sean, you probably get into Cornell, right?
No, I would completely agree with that statement.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us today. Fun episode. Hope you guys enjoy it. Please give me some feedback on Twitter, and we'll see you here next week. Thanks.
Thanks for downloading Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah. For more, go to nfl.com/podcasts.